Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on Can They Do That? Right after this. You know, back in 1787, the writers of our Constitution put in this clause at Article 1, Section 10. It says, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt." Now, that clause follows the biblical injunction on just weights and balances that we see in Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. Now, private business is carried on in gold and silver coin. It's public business that is conducted in commercial paper. Paper like stocks, bonds, Federal Reserve notes, credit cards, debt, usury. Well, back in 1965, Congress said that there's no difference in the value of gold and silver coin versus clad coin or currency. And you know that's very true when we're dealing with banks, government, and commercial industries. But out here in the real marketplace, there's a 7-to-1 difference in the purchasing power of gold over paper money. And there's a 7-to-1 difference in the taxes that are due on that paper money versus gold and silver. Now, God and our founding fathers didn't give us gold and silver coin for no good purpose. They knew that as a matter of law, gold and silver coin was absolutely necessary for us to deal in order for us to establish our property rights. Well, neither did our Congress and politicians take our gold and silver coin away from us for no good reason either. They knew, and they knew full well back in 1933, that in order to subjugate a free people, they would first have to take away the people's gold and silver coin in order to take away the people's right to property so that they could destroy the people's property rights. Now, if you and I intend to regain our rights, duties, and capacities, then we must first regain our property and property rights. And that's because property is the legal foundation for all of our liberties. So let me show you how to do just that. And that's in our business school, which is now on compact disc for adult home school. Now, if you'd like more information about our private business school, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package first. That's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. Remember, it's informative, it's entertaining, it's educational. Best of all, it's free. You can call and order one right now. It's the place to start. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, our business school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click on to the email. Send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Now, once more, that's georgegordon.org. Or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Why don't you do it right now while you're thinking about it? All right, we're talking about can they do that? Oftentimes I'm asked when somebody calls, they'll complain about some company or corporation, some business or enterprise, some government institution, a policeman, a public officer or official has done something, and this person wants to know, well, can they do that? And I always tell them, well, of course they can do that. They already have. And that's why you're calling me, and that's why you're complaining. The real question should be, is that lawful or legal? Do I have to comply? Or is there any recourse? Can I tell them no? You know, one of the big problems that we have in the Scripture is that we have failed to tell the evildoers no. You go into court, and the And the clerk says, raise your right hand and repeat after me. And so most people just raise their right hand and they said, you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God. Now that's against the law to do that. It violates the law of God. God told you, do not take an oath. And he told you that twice in the New Testament, once in the Old. Now for you Christians out there, you're not concerned with the Old Testament because that's been abolished and done away with. But Jesus, twice in the New Testament, once in Matthew 5:33-37, directly, eyeball to eyeball, said, don't forswear yourself, don't take an oath, let your yea be yea and your nay be nay. James, one of the apostles, in James 5:12, makes the same statement. So twice in the New Testament, for you Christians out there, you're told not to do that. Now, there are some Christians that picked up on that and said, oh, maybe we shouldn't do that. And so they objected, and the state came in and said, okay, well, for you objectors out there, here's what we'll do. We'll change the word swear to affirm. So they did. And now these objectors come in, raise your right hand, and repeat after me. Do you affirm that the testimony that you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? So help you God. Now that's an oath by a euphemism. A euphemism. That's a word that we use in place of. That's a little I say have to make us feel real good. For instance, if I said, would you like to go out and commit adultery tonight? You might say, oh no, I don't think I want to go out and commit adultery. So I come back with a euphemism and I say, well, would you like to go out honky-tonking tonight? Oh, yeah, I'd like to do that. Can you tell me what the difference is? You know, when you're out here bar hopping, what's the ultimate objective of the evening? It's to pick up a chicken layer. Come on, guys, let's wake up and smell the coffee. Whether I say, hey, let's go out and tear off a little, let's go down to the whorehouse, let's go out and, hey, come on, it's time to wake up and smell the coffee. It makes us feel good, you know, to say, oh, we're going out cruising, or we're going out honky-tonking, or we're, you know, we can hang a different label on there, but the real meaning, the real intent, the real purpose behind tonight's escapade is adultery. That's our purpose. Or fornication, you know, if you don't happen to be married. So when we get down to can they do that, certainly the government can stick in front of you this criminal choice. Have you ever heard someone say, no, I'm not going to swear, and no, I'm not going to affirm either. I'm just going to let my yea be yea and my nay be nay. Now, the judge is going to threaten you. I went through this one time. He's going to threaten you. If you don't take this oath or this affirmation, which is the modality that we provide for, I'm going to hold you in contempt of court and throw you in jail. You ever heard of, or you ever see somebody say, well, I'm sorry that you feel that way about it, Judge, and I really don't want to go to jail, but Jesus told me not to do that, and so I'm just going to obey God and keep His commandments. And because this law, because this rule, regulation, custom, usage, or practice violates the law of God, I'm not going to do that. How many times have you ever seen that done? How many times have you ever seen somebody tell a policeman, a public official, or some clerk in a company or a store someplace that, no, I'm not going to do that. It's against the law to do that. Well, if you don't do that, then we're not going to sell you electric power. If you don't do that, then we're not going to turn on your telephone. If you don't do that, you know, here we're going to call a cop. Now, most people, when confronted with this kind of a confrontation, will always back down and comply with whatever rule, regulation, custom, usage, or practice is being imposed upon them. And then they'll ask the question, well, can they do that? And the answer is yes. Failure to object timely is fatal. Can you remember that, boys and girls? It's called a maxim of law. Maxim. M-A-X-I-M. Maxim. It's a given in law. This is the way it works. Now, if you object timely, you create what's known as the contested issue of fact or the contested issue of law. You have to have one or the other. If you're going to have an action, if you're going to have a cause, then you have to have a contested issue of fact. So let me tell you a little story here, and let's see where we go with that. Let's suppose, for the sake of our discussion here, that you're in the ice cream business, and I'm selling ice cream. So I come up to you one day, and I say, hey, where are you buying your ice cream? And you say, well, I buy my ice cream from Blue Bunny or from Haagen-Dazs or somebody, you know? And I say, well, why don't you buy some Gordon ice cream? My ice cream is pretty good ice cream. Besides that, I sell it for half price. I'm a lot cheaper than these other guys out here. And besides that, my ice cream doesn't have any chemicals in it. And I've got all these neat benefits. And so we talk about ice cream, and pretty soon you say, well, you know, Gordon, you got a pretty good sales line there. And you probably got a pretty good ice cream. And I give you a sample of it, and you say, wow, that's really great stuff. I'd like to sell your ice cream. And that's okay. We need a one-year contract, and here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to deliver ice cream to you on Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays. And you're going to pay me cash when I deliver the ice cream. And you're going to agree to buy my ice cream on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for one full year, beginning on, and we write it up, and we put in a date, and we start off. And so I come by, and I deliver you your ice cream on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and you pay me. And then I come by the next week, and Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, I deliver your ice cream. Things are going along great. Everything's fine. And then one day I deliver your ice cream on Monday, Wednesday, but I don't deliver your ice cream on Friday, but I come back the following Monday, and you say, Gordon, how come you didn't deliver my ice cream on Friday? I ran out of ice cream, and I had lost all these sales over the weekend. And I say, well, Bob, I'm sorry that I didn't get here on Friday, but you see, I had a flat tire. And because I had a flat tire, you know, I missed some of my deliveries, and yours was one of them. And I'm really sorry. I apologize. I just can't tell you how sorry I am that I made this mistake. And maybe even with tears in my eyes, you say, well, okay, you know, things happen, and so I'll forgive you for that. And so we go about our business, and I deliver the ice cream on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and one day I deliver the ice cream on Friday and Monday, but I don't deliver the ice cream on Wednesday. I missed Wednesday now again. And so I show up on Friday, and I'm delivering the ice cream, and you say, Gordon, hey, you, how come you didn't deliver the ice cream on Wednesday? I ran out of ice cream because you didn't deliver my delivery, and I lost all my sales on Thursday. And I say, look, you know, things happen. And my truck broke down again, and I was getting it fixed, and because I didn't have a truck, I couldn't deliver the ice cream, and so I'm really sorry, and I apologize, and things happen, and so you and I iron it out, and you say, well, okay, things happen, and so I didn't get my ice cream on Wednesday, but okay, we'll go on from there. And so we go on. I deliver your ice cream on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and I deliver your ice cream on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and things are going along pretty good. And one day, I deliver your ice cream on Wednesday and Friday, and then the following Monday, I missed Monday. I didn't deliver on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. I did on Wednesday and Friday, but I missed Monday. And so now, you say, Gordon, wait a minute. Now, hang on a second here. You missed on a Friday, you missed on a Wednesday, and now you're missing on a Monday. And how come you missed delivery? And I say, well, I went fishing. You went fishing, yeah. You know, a man has to have a vacation every once in a while. You can't work 24 hours, 7 days a week, so you have to have a good little fishing. You know, don't you go fishing, Bob? Well, yeah, I go fishing, okay. Well, what's wrong with a man going fishing? So, you know, that's it. I'm sorry that I didn't come on Monday, but I was bummed out, and I needed a little rest, and so I took a fishing trip. But, hey, I'll tell you what I'll do. Seeing how I missed on Monday, I'm gonna give you an extra bonus here. I'm gonna give you an extra jag of ice cream, and I'm not even gonna charge you for it. How's that? Will that mollify things? And you say, well, okay, Gordon, it's okay. I'll take a little jag ice cream, and it makes me feel better. And okay, we'll go on from there. So now, some time goes by, and I'm delivering ice cream to you Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and all of a sudden, I just miss Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Hell, I don't even show up for the whole week. So I follow through on the following Monday, and I drive up, and I'm ready to deliver ice cream, and you say, you know, Gordon, I've about had it with you. In fact, I want to let you know I've had it with you. You didn't show up on Monday, Wednesday, or Friday. So I went back to my old supplier supplying me with ice cream. And I said, gee, Tom, sorry to hear that. And then you say to me, well, you can just take your ice cream and stuff it. And I said, well, Tom, Tom, that's fine. And I hear you loud and clear. But remember that clause in our contract that said you agreed to buy ice cream from me for a full year? Well, the year's not up, Tom. And so now, you can buy ice cream from me, and I will deliver the ice cream to you when it's convenient for me. I may be here on Monday, I may be here on Wednesday, I may be here on Friday, or I may not be here at all. And I expect you to pay me for my ice cream every time I deliver, whether or not I show up on Monday, Wednesday, or Friday. And you say, that's preposterous, Gordon. You're a nutcase. You've breached the contract. You breached the contract four times now. And I say, Tom, no, I haven't breached the contract at all. You see, we've simply changed the terms and conditions of the contract from delivery on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday to delivery anytime I want to or not at all. And you agreed to it. No, you protest. No, I didn't agree to that. Oh, yeah, you agreed to it. You see, the first time that I missed on Friday, you agreed to the new terms and conditions. If I miss on Friday, you'll accept delivery on Monday and pay me for it. And if I miss on Wednesday, it's okay. You'll forgive that indiscretion, and you'll pay me for the following delivery. And the same thing with Monday. So now we've established that you will accept delivery after I've missed on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and you have now, by your actions, accepted the new terms and conditions of the contract. From, I will deliver on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, to, if I show up. And the question arises, can they do that? And the answer is, well, of course. I just did it. And if you sue me, or if you stop paying me when I come by to deliver ice cream, I'm going to sue you for non-performance, and I'm going to win. Well, that's not fair. That's not right. I don't know. I don't make these laws, boys and girls. I don't make things the way they are. It's not that George Gordon has decreed this. I'm just a reporter. I'm just here to tell you that's the way it works. Now, Tom, if you didn't like the idea of changing the delivery schedule from Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, the very first time I missed delivery on Friday was a breach of contract. And the following Monday, when I said, gee, I had a flat tire, you should have said, well, you should have two delivery trucks, Mr. Gordon, or you should have a spare. Now, our agreement calls for delivery on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. You didn't deliver on Friday. Contract's broken. I'm terminating the contract. I'm not buying your ice cream. Period. It's the end of the report. Get out of here. I can sue you until the cows come home. I can't prevail because I broke the contract. But after I broke the contract, you see, you ratified the new contract. And the new contract was verbal. Let me point something out to you. All contracts are verbal. When I say that to people, sometimes they look at me and they say, no, I got mine here in writing. Here's the piece of paper right there. I said, the writing is not the contract. That people look at me and they say, well, yeah, sure it is. Here's the piece of paper right there. I said, that's not the contract. Well, what is this piece of paper? That contract is the highest and best evidence of the contract. That piece of paper that has the terms and conditions written down on it isn't the contract. The contract was the meeting of the minds that we had when we made our agreement. The contract was an offer with an acceptance over time with consideration. Four elements to a contract. It has to have an offer. I came to you and I said, I offer to deliver ice cream to you. You accepted. I accept. Over time, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. With consideration, you pay me when I deliver. And you agreed to take the ice cream for a full year. Now, the new terms and conditions of the contract are also oral, but in this case, they're not written down. Contracts don't have to be written down. It's best if they're written down. I don't deny that, but they don't have to be written down to have a contract. And that's because the contract is the offer with the acceptance over time with consideration. And if we happen to write it down, the piece of paper is the highest and best evidence of the agreement. It's where you come in and you say, well, here's what he agreed to. And I come back with witness and say, but here's how we changed it. And he agreed to the change by accepting the ice cream deliveries from then on. And people say, well, can they do that? Absolutely. So if you want to call a contract, you call it when there's a breach. And as soon as there's a breach, typically your state statutes will say, well, you've got a statute of limitations here. And within this period of time, you've got to raise your objection. And so if you don't raise your objection, well, then failure to object timely is fatal. Always remember that. Now, let me show you another little factoid here that maybe you'd never heard of before. Do you have to identify yourself to a policeman? Ever thought about that? The police always want you to identify yourself. You know, you've been stopped by the policeman. He comes up to the window and says, let me see your driver's license. Do you have to give him your driver's license? Well, if you have one, you have to give it to him. If you don't have one, then you can't give it to him. Can you? Or have you ever had a policeman demand that you identify yourself? That happens once in a while. The guy's walking down the street. Or maybe he's just sleeping in a doorway. And somebody calls the cops and says, hey, this guy's sleeping in the doorway. Get him out of here. And so the cops come over and they stand him up. And one of the first things they'll do, what's your name? Do you have to tell this guy your name? I mean, mull that one over for a second. Do I have some duty or obligation to identify myself to the policeman? I suppose for the sake, I remember one time I had a policeman stop me and he asked me for my driver's license and I didn't say anything. And he said, did you hear me? And I didn't say anything. I didn't shake my head. I didn't say anything. And then he said, have you been drinking? I didn't say anything. And he said, can you hear me? And I didn't say anything. He said, are you deaf? I didn't say anything. And then he said, you're under arrest. And then I didn't say anything. And then he said, turn around. So I turned around. And he took my hands and he handcuffed me, and I didn't say anything. And so he said, get in the back of the car. And I got in the back of the car, and he said, you're not deaf. And I didn't say anything. And then he closed the door, and he searched me. And before he put me inside the car, he searched me. And he didn't find anything. I didn't have anything on me. And he said, where's your wallet? And I didn't say anything. And he said, what's your name? And I didn't say anything. And he was asking me all these questions, and he's talking to me. I never said a word. I didn't argue with him. I didn't I didn't threaten him. I didn't say yes, sir, or no, sir. I didn't say go to hell, or I didn't say a thing. Zero, zilch, not a word came out of my mouth. Have you ever heard this statement? You have certain rights, and you have a right to remain silent. And if you elect not to remain silent, anything you say can and will be held against you, or used against you in a court of law. It's called the famous Miranda warning. Did you know that? You've heard that statement? What would happen if you actually followed the law and you didn't say anything? That's a wild new concept, isn't it? The policeman says, "Hey, what's your name?" And you don't answer. You don't say anything. Can you speak? You don't say anything. Are you deaf? You don't say anything. The policeman says, "You're under arrest." You don't say anything. He searches you. You don't resist. You don't say anything. He asks you, "Where's your wallet?" You don't say anything. Aren't you practicing Miranda? Have any of you people ever out there ever thought about actually practicing the law yourselves? I know it's a wild new idea, but the policeman says, "You're under arrest, and you have a right to remain silent. And then if you elect to speak, anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law." Now the guy starts off, says, "What's your name, address, and phone number?" And people follow him. My name is George Gordon, and I live at 2204 Jones Road, and I killed my wife, and the gun's under the patio. I mean, you people just can't wait to talk, confess, give him all the information that he needs. I'm not quite sure why you do that, but you certainly do. Now the policeman's been up front. He said, "If you elect to remain silent, I have to remind you, you have a right to remain silent. And if you elect to waive that right and speak to me, anything you say to me, I'm going to use against you and do everything in my power to put you in prison with your own words." And you people just get out there and can't talk fast enough and can't talk long enough. You know that? And that's after you've been told. See? In fact, the Supreme Court in the Miranda case said, "Well, most people probably don't know they've got this right to remain silent. And so we're going to require that you tell them that they've got this right." And even after they've been told, they still have to speak. So I had a student one time. His name was Fred, down in Deming, New Mexico. And down in Deming, New Mexico, they had a city ordinance. I don't think this is a state statute. Now, 24 states in the union have a statute on the books. This is a state law now, that says thou shalt identify thyself to the policeman. Well, words to those that effect. 26 states do not. So it's just about 50-50, about half and half. Now, most people do not see that giving the name, address, and social security number and marital status and all these routine facts have anything to do with the arrest or the policeman. And they think that it's a law, that it's some kind of a duty. The policeman never tells them, you know, after he's given them their Miranda warning, after they've been Mirandaized, the police call it, after we've Mirandaized this guy. And then they start asking him questions, and of course, The average Joe Sixpack presumes that the policeman isn't going to ask him any questions that are improper. Hell, the policeman's your enemy. He's your foe. See, most people have been taught that the policeman is your friend. Or that when you go to court, you get a fair trial. You know? Oh, okay. You've been to public school again, haven't you, son? No, the policeman is your adversary. Your policeman there, he's gathering evidence. He's trained. He's a paid professional. That's his job, to get the evidence that he needs to convict you and put you in jail. Now, he has to follow certain rules. He knows what the rules are. You don't. You haven't got a clue. And so he starts right off by asking you for your identification. It ever occurred to you that you don't have any corresponding duty to tell him who in the hell you are? I had a guy say one time, "Well, how could they prosecute you if they didn't know what your name was?" Well, that's a good point. If they had to have your name in order to prosecute you, well, then why in hell would you want to tell him? But the police don't have to have your name to prosecute you. That's crazy. You mean to tell me you go out here and you kill somebody in cold blood in front of 15 witnesses. The policeman comes up, arrests, and says, who are you? And you won't tell him. And so he says, well, if I don't know who you are, I guess I got to let you go. You don't have a wallet, don't have a driver's license, you don't have a social security number, and I can't figure out who you are. So, well, I guess I'll just have to go on back to headquarters. Let's suppose they arrested you and took you to jail, fingerprinted you and went all over you and couldn't figure out who you were. They looked everywhere. You never had a record before, never been in the Army, never had a birth certificate, never had a fingerprint taken. You won't tell them. You've killed a guy, or five, 15 witnesses. And the police say, well, since we can't identify him, had him in jail here for 2 weeks, worked hard, couldn't identify him, guess we've got to turn loose. Do you believe that? They will name you John Doe, prosecute you, convict you, take you off, hang you, and bury you under the name John Doe. We don't need to know your name. So I just thought I'd pass that one along to you. We'll come back to Fred's story right after we go through our mid-course reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective, not state schools and all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, all of which can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school and asking for it. All you have to do is call us. Number's 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we endorse will necessarily reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine, they're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about can they do that? Oftentimes we get asked, can the police do that? And I always tell people, of course, they've already done it. Now, the issue that we need to discuss here is, do you have to comply? Sometimes the police may have a duty to identify you, but that doesn't mean that you have some corresponding duty to identify yourself. The policeman has duties, you don't have any corresponding duty. And then the policeman, maybe he uses some trickery or chicanery to get what he wants or what he needs. Oftentimes, if I have a subpoena to serve and I can't find you at home, I may have to use some other means to get you served. If I call you on the telephone and say, I've got a subpoena for you, can I come over and serve you? You might tell me no. So, well then, can I make an appointment? No. Can I serve this subpoena on you? No. Now, wait a minute. I have a duty to serve this subpoena and you won't cooperate with me. Can you do that? Certainly. It's called ducking service of process. And so when you're a process server, sometimes you have to be sneaky about the way you serve this process. So my boy one time had to serve a deputy sheriff here in Ada County, or Ozark County, excuse me. And he just couldn't catch this guy. He was as slippery as an eel. And so one day my boy called him up and he said, Tom, listen, I need to buy some fishing lures. Now, Tom not only was a deputy sheriff, but he made fishing lures. And he said, I'd like to come over and look at your stock. And they made an appointment for 7 o'clock. And so my boy went over to his place, and they looked over the fishing lures. And my boy bought 4 or 5 of them. They're really good. And this deputy made great fishing lures. And so after they finished their transaction, he said, thank you very much. I'm really, really appreciative of these fishing lures. And he said, oh, by the way, Tom, let me give you a subpoena. Now you've been served. Well, Tom said, well, that was pretty tricky. Thank you. And he left. Now, you know that the deputy, he's a process server, too. You know, sometimes he has to get a little sneaky in order to get the process served. But just to point out to you, you know, that, well, can they do that? Well, that's, yeah, they can do that. Sure. It's the way that's done. Well, old Fred over here, he lives in Deming, New Mexico, and they've got a city ordinance that says you have to identify yourself. Now, there's 3 cases here, Brown, Heibel, and Lawson, that deal with this thing out of the U.S. Supreme Court of identifying yourself to the policeman. I'm not going to get into Brown, Lawson, and Heibel per se, but let me just tell you that you don't have a duty to identify yourself to a policeman. In the 24 states that have that statute that says thou shalt identify thyself to a policeman, there are Fourth and Fifth Amendment considerations with the identification. And that comes under a thing called Heibel. The court just decided that here a couple of years ago. But they didn't overturn Brown and they didn't overturn Lawson. They just staked out new territory and said, well, we got a new rule over here called Heibel. And so now we got 3 cases instead of 2. So in this case, Fred wanted to overturn this law. He didn't like the law, and he wanted to set it up. And so he strapped on a .45, and he walked down Main Street. Now, how many of you people, you have a Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms. How many of you actually practice your Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms? Well, you can tell how many people do that by just walking down the street and noticing how many people are packing heat. I observe policemen doing that. Policemen pretty much observe the Second Amendment, and you'll see them carrying a gun down Main Street. Policemen are the only people in America, as a general rule, that practice the Second Amendment. Everybody else could, but they don't. So here's Fred. He's walking down the street packing heat. Now, a policeman's driving down the street in his car, and he sees Fred walking down the street, and he's packing a gun, and so the policeman pulled up to the curb, rolled down his window, and he says, hey, you, come here. Fred stopped, bent down, looked in the window, and the guy says, this is the policeman. Now, he says to Fred, he says, let me see some identification. And Fred asked him, am I under arrest? And the policeman said, no. And Fred said, I don't want to talk to you. And he just turned on his heel and started walking down the street. Now, the policeman, think about this. You know, you're the cop. You're sitting in the car. You stop. You ask this guy to give you some identification. You're in full uniform. You're driving the city police car. And this guy just turns on his heel and, in effect, says, go to hell. Are you going to let him get away with that, officer? Well, I should say not. So Fred said that the policeman was so incensed. Now, by now, see, Fred's walking away. You know, by the time the policeman looks at Fred walking away, Fred's down the street 10, 15, 20 feet. So the cop steps on the gas, peels rubber, drives 30, 40, 50 feet, whatever it is, slams on the brakes. I guess he did this to show Fred that police cars have a lot of horsepower. He jumps out of his car, races around the front of the car, jumps up on the sidewalk, gets right up in Fred's face, you know, kind of like a drill sergeant at a Marine base, gets in Fred's face. Doesn't touch Fred now. He didn't touch him. Just got up in his face and he said, "I said I want to see some identification." And Fred said, "Am I under arrest?" And the cop was so ticked off, he said, "Yes, you're under arrest." Fred said, "Okay, I'll go quietly." Now, the policeman wasn't thinking very well here. This is not quite the way that the policeman is supposed to perform, but, you know, people are people, and policemen are people, and this policeman said, "You know, I've had enough of this jerk," so he handcuffs Fred, and he pats him down, and he searches him, and he doesn't find any wallet. See, most of you people out there are like cows. See, we farmers, we identify our cows. We put tags in their ears so I can see old number 42. We put brands on them. We burn brands right into their hides. We put chips under their skin. We put tattoos in their ears. We affix metal clips to their ears to identify our cows, our livestock. Now, the state does the same thing. The state, they come along and they give you numbers, like Social Security numbers and driver's licenses and business licenses, and they put your name on there and your birth date, and they identify you. Then they tell you, don't leave home without it. I remember I got my draft card, you know, when I was a youngster, and it said, you must carry this draft card with you at all times. So I went down and registered for the draft, a voluntary act. And then after I registered for the draft, they gave me a piece of paper. It said, don't you leave home without it. You got to carry it on your person at all times. Mine didn't last too long. I carried it on my person all the time. You know, I'd get in the shower, get in the bathtub, and after a while, the paper just disintegrated. So the instruction to carry this on your person at all times really wasn't a very good law, because they got to give you something better than a piece of paper. I guess they could give you a plastic card so that when you're in the bathtub, you know, it doesn't wreck the paper. But moral to the story was, I carried it with me faithfully for years and years so that my master could identify me. Drivers do that. Old people do that. Of course, old people probably ought to carry their Social Security numbers. They might have dementia and get lost, and they need somebody to identify them so that they can take them back to the rest home. But I wasn't suffering from dementia, neither was Fred. And so the policeman searched him. He couldn't find anything on him. Took him down to headquarters and processed him through. Fred bailed out and went down the street. Now, as this case wound its way through the process, Brown came in arguing Brown and Lawson, and they released him. The trial court judge released him. There's no law that requires... Fred's not breaking any law. There's no law in Deming, New Mexico, that says you can't walk down the street with a 45. He wasn't arrested for walking down the street with a gun. He was arrested for failure to identify himself to a police officer under the city ordinance. Do cities, counties, and states enact laws that violate the law of the United States or violate the law of God? All the time. That's why you have appellate courts. That's why you have Supreme Courts in your states and in Washington, and appellate courts and circuit courts of appeal. It's because trial courts in cities and counties make mistakes and they pass laws that are illegal. They do it all the time. In fact, we took a survey one time at Barrister's Inn, and we looked through a random sampling of 100 state statutes. in Idaho, 100 state statutes. And our conclusion was, I got to concede, now I'm not a paid professional, I didn't go to law school, but our observation was, based upon the standards set down by the Supreme Court in reviewing cases, that 75% of the cases, 75% rather of the statutes in Idaho, are unconstitutional, either on their face or as they are applied to some individuals. And those are the standards that the court uses. Now, the chances of a statute being unconstitutional on its face is very, very remote. In fact, it's about 10% statistically. And that's pretty significant, because that tells us that 10% of the statutes that are on your law books are unconstitutional on their face. Now, a sample of a case like that would be making blacks ride the back of the bus. That statute was not only unconstitutional as it applied to individuals, it was also unconstitutional on its face. You couldn't apply that to anybody at any time for any cause or reason. And the court said so and overturned it. Now, in the case of Yoder versus Wisconsin, for instance, that's the Amish guy that pulled his kids out of school in the eighth grade. That statute, that compulsory education statute, of and by itself is not unconstitutional. And for all of you Catholics, Protestants, and Jews, it applies to you. It just doesn't apply to Amish people or other religious objectors, using the Seeger standards. Now, a lot of times people will call the law school and say, well, that can't be right. You can't have laws that apply to some people and don't apply to others. Well, certainly you can. We do it all the time. Amish people don't send their children to school until they're 16. You do. And you should. All you Catholics, Protestants, and Jews. You should. The law doesn't apply to Amish people. It applies to Catholics. Now, if that just makes you mad as hell, that's my point. And you say, well, can they do that? Absolutely. Just told you. Explained it to you. Then people, they get kind of upset, and they say, well, but, you know, sound like a motorboat, you know, but. So Fred then turned around and filed an action against the city under the Civil Rights Act for false arrest and false imprisonment. I don't remember what the numbers were, not really relevant, but so the case goes into federal court, and so now we're trying to qualify this case for trial, and as we get started, see, the city's got insurance, and so the insurance company comes over to Fred, and they want to settle this out of court. It's called a nuisance value settlement. And so Fred says, well, listen, we can settle this out of court for a nuisance value settlement upon the condition that the city repeal or remove the statute from the books. And the insurance company underwriter said, well, we can't tell the city what to do and how to do it. And Fred said, well, of course you can. And he said, that's my terms and conditions. Otherwise, we're going to go to trial. Now, get this. See, if we take this thing to trial, Fred's either going to win or lose. Doesn't make any difference. He'll take it to appeal and to appeal. And by the time this thing gets to the U.S. Supreme Court, the insurance company's going to be out $100,000. And the insurance company doesn't want to spend $100,000. They just want to pay Fred $10,000, and let's all walk away from this. Fred says, give me my $10,000 nuisance value settlement, but take the law off the books. And if you don't, I'm going to take you to trial, because I can qualify this for trial. Just like Heibel, just like Brown, just like Lawson. This is a res judicata case, and because of that, I'm going to go in here and I'm going to say, wait a minute, you can't do that to me as an individual. This law is unconstitutional as it applies to me. It's not unconstitutional on its face. Heibel shows that. We're not arguing that. But in this case, under these circumstances, as this law is being applied to me, it's unconstitutional. And I'm not going to sit still for it. Now, the insurance company has a lot of power over cities and counties and states. And Well, not so much the state, but cities and counties they do. And here's what comes down. You see, the claims manager walks into the mayor and he says, "Now look, you know, you're paying us $500,000 a year for liability insurance, and you went out here and you arrested a guy and jailed him falsely. You cannot compel this guy to identify himself. It violates Brown v. Texas and Lawson v. Colander." And now remember, this is before Heibel. But even if we had Heibel in the case, Fred has an interest in his Fourth and Fifth Amendment rights. You know, what if he was Osama bin Laden? What if he looked like Osama bin Laden? And if he told him his name, "Well, my name is Osama bin Laden." Well, wait a minute. If Fred did that, wouldn't that be compelling him to confess in violation of Miranda, violation of his Fourth and Fifth Amendment rights to remain silent, to be protected in his person? You know, there's other interests that need to be taken into consideration here. And so bottom line, you know, we get down here to where the rubber meets the road. The insurance company, their main interest is collecting premiums and not paying out claims. That's the insurance company's business. All they want to do is collect premiums. They do not want to pay out claims. If you thought insurance companies are there to pay out claims, to make things right with people, make them whole, then you belong back on Lollapoochia. You know, you're out here in La La Land someplace. So, pretty soon, you know, the city council, the mayor, rather, kind of objected to this, and he gave the claims adjuster a little static, so we learned a little later, but the claims adjuster said, "Well, okay, then we're going to just increase your premiums from $500,000 to $1 million a year then to cover these kinds of exposures." See where we're going with this? And so the mayor says, "Oh, you're going to double our premiums." "Oh, well, in that case, the mayor goes into executive session with the city council. That is, we don't need any people present. And they just repealed the ordinance. Took the ordinance off the books. So then next step in the scenario is, okay, well, let's go to a settlement conference. And so now they sit down and they settle out, and Fred takes a check, and the city takes the law off the books, and their premiums stay the same, and everybody leaves friends, and nobody out there on the street is any the wiser. And do the policemen still demand identification? Absolutely. Absolutely. Not going to change anything. Out in California, after the Brown decision came down back about 1979, California had a law on the books, and California is one of those 24 states that has this identification requirement. And so, do you think California or any of these states are going to take their laws off the books just because the Supreme Court rules that it's unconstitutional? Did you know that the vagrancy statute was declared unconstitutional in 1964? And the courts of America convict 500,000 Americans a year for vagrancy on a statute that was overturned in 1964. Did you know that? Failure to object timely, that's all. You don't have to take a statute off the books just because it's been declared unconstitutional or illegal or unlawful or anything else. And that's because these statutes, like identification, none of the average Joe Sixpacks out there know or understand that. And the police do. So the policeman comes up, he demands your identification. Hell, 99.999% of people just comply. They're afraid not to. They wouldn't know how to go defend the case or how to go in and win the case, even if they knew the law was unconstitutional or believed that it was unconstitutional. And that's because the government has a lot of intimidating power. And many times people are cunningly coerced into waiving their rights due to their ignorance. That's what it boils down to. Can they do that? Well, if you let them. You know, somebody has to stand up and say, no, that's against the law. I'm not going to do that. The census is a violation of biblical law. You people out there all comply with the census. Insurance is a violation of scriptural law. You people all buy insurance. I mean, I could go through a number of laws here that are scripturally a violation of the scripture. And you know, you practice it every day. You go down and get a driver's license, and they ask you for your birth date, and you give it to them. That's witchcraft. That's practicing observing times. Observing times is a practice of witchcraft, which is prohibited in Leviticus 20, verse 27. Now, most of you people don't practice sodomy. Wouldn't think of it. Wouldn't even enter your mind. But you violate laws in the scripture, such as you eat fat. And the fat law is in Leviticus 3, verse 17. It says, you shall eat no manner of fat. So you go into McDonald's and you eat a hamburger. You eat 30% fat. Who licensed McDonald's to sell fat in their hamburger? The state. The census. Public school. Inheritance tax. Real estate sales by license. Birthdays. You know, these are things that are prohibited by God, practiced by people, endorsed by the state, and in most cases promoted by the state, and in many cases even ordered by the state, like taking an oath. That's ordered by the state. And people comply with and violate the law of God, and in many cases they violate the Constitution of the United States by complying with laws that they don't have to. Once in a while, there's a Rosa Parks comes up and says, no, I ain't riding the back of the bus. And then sometimes the Supreme Court will take a law like that and strike it down and say, wait a minute, you can't do that. Or like Yoder versus Wisconsin, hey, wait a minute, you can't do that to these people. But the average guy, see, he doesn't know that. And then the question arises, well, can they do that? And people write me letters and they call the law school and they say, well, can they do that? And they tell me all these stories over here. That's why I thought I'd share them with you. The Fred Froelich story. Can the policeman demand identification? Certainly he can demand it. Do you have any corresponding duty? That's the real issue here. And in some cases, you may have a duty to identify yourself. Just your name. My name is George Gordon. In some cases, like Heibel versus Nevada, you have a duty. My name is George Gordon. What's your social security number? Are you married? Where do you live? And what's your occupation? You don't have any other duty to go any further than just your name. That's the bottom line. Don't have to give them your birth date, social security number. You don't have to carry a wallet with you that carries your identification like a cow carrying an ear tag or a tattoo or a brand. See? Well, not yet. Not yet. Many of you people out there in the world live under governments that require you to identify your... Well, that's because you're owned by the state. You know, if you stop and think about ownership, a farmer requires his cows to carry a tag in their ears because they're the chattel property of the farmer. So it shouldn't be strange, then, for your master, the government, to require you, their property, to carry identification at all times so that you can be identified. How do you like that? Well, I'm out of time here again. Children, we're going to have to leave it right there and remind you that you are listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, our time's up. We got to leave it right there. So we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.